Hello, everybody. My name is Daniel Prince, and I'm the host of the Once Bitten podcast. This is a podcast focused on Bitcoin. It's my mission to interview as many people as I can around the different aspects of Bitcoin and help people understand exactly what Bitcoin could mean for them and for their families and for their future. I hope you enjoy the show. Thank you so much for listening. Hey guys, welcome to the show. Today's guest, Danny Brewster from the UK, from Fast Bitcoins, and it's a great episode. It's nice to have a British company again on the show that are Bitcoin only and building something really great in the space, which is going to be so easy for people to use and get access to Bitcoin. So let's get into it. I hope you enjoy this one. Stick around because he's got an amazing story up his sleeve. Thanks as always for listening. And please make sure, guys, go check out coinfloor.co.uk/bitten to start your stacking sats journey. And just start investing a little bit a week, guys, or daily. You know, you can get down to, I think the minimums are like 50 pence. You know, there's no excuse to not start stacking a few sats away and joining us on this journey into the rabbit hole of Bitcoin. Hey guys, welcome to today's show. And with me today is Danny Brewster from Fast Bitcoins, based out of the UK. Danny, welcome to the show. Thank you. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
And Lauren is here, as usual, to ask the first question. So do you want to fire away?
Why did you make a Bitcoin business?
Good question. Because I'm a little bit crazy. I think I can help change the world and make the world a better place if we have more people with a little bit of Bitcoin in their pocket. So your generation and my daughter's generation and then my grandchildren's generation can live in a world that's a little bit more peaceful. That's why.
Okay, and I got another question. Go. How old is your daughter?
I've got four stepchildren and one daughter. My daughter is 12. I've got one stepdaughter that's 13, one that's 15, one that's 17, and a stepson that is 11.
Wow!
And we have two dogs, two cats, one cat called Satoshi. We used to have a cat called Nakamoto. And we've got two leopard geckos. So we've got lots going on in our house.
And trying to run a business at the same time.
And I run the business from home.
That's very hard.
It's fun. So I wouldn't have it any other way.
How about that?
That's a good answer. Says,
what do we have here? We got three kids, three chickens.
Yeah. Including me.
Yeah, you are one of the kids, yes. Yeah.
There's four.
Four kids, three chickens. What am I even thinking? I forgot about a kid. Which one did I forget?
Okay, let's see. I think you forgot Sophia.
It's a good, just don't let the wife hear that you're forgetting one of the children.
Well, yeah, luckily none of the family, like literally none of the family listens to podcasts. So that's all good, huh? Even mum and dad and my brothers. I'll get away with that one.
Yeah, you will, because they won't listen. Don't believe about Bitcoin.
Not yet.
No.
They don't believe in it?
Nope.
Okay, so, but you haven't got the time to talk them into it?
Well, my dad has tried a few times, but...
I think there was a famous Satoshi saying, I have neither the time nor inclination to try and convince you. You will just be shown.
It will get all of us one day.
Yeah.
And we will slowly start to understand.
And then everybody will go like, why didn't you tell us in the first place?
Yeah.
We've been telling you for like years and you won't listen.
Yeah, we've been doing this for 10 years telling people. I had a good friend tell me yesterday, I wish I'd listened to you 10 years ago. And these days, I don't even really preach to friends and family anymore. I think it was when Obi was on with you, Obi from CoinFloor. Was saying that he used to be that Bitcoin guy at every social gathering, meeting, just pushing Bitcoin, Bitcoin, Bitcoin. And you get to a point where you're no longer that person and people just gravitate towards you. And I always use now a great indicator I call it my great bubble indicator, is when my barber is trying to shill Ripple to me. Not that I need a barber now, because I have the COVID haircut, where the missus gave it her best shot. But yeah, when the barber tries to shill me Ripple or some other altcoin, then I know we're really in a bubble.
Yeah, that is definitely a red flag. Right, well, do you want to...
Yeah, say goodbye and good night.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, and I hope your business is carrying on.
Me too. Bye. All I can do is try.
Exactly. Thank you, mate.
You must be so proud.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great. It's funny, actually. I recorded with another guest a little earlier on, and as I was setting up, I heard her playing with her dolls next door. And she's like, hey, guys, how are you? Yeah, not bad. Hey, do you know about Bitcoin? Huh? Bitcoin, what's that? And I was sitting here like, yes. She's even playing Bitcoin dolls now. So it's slowly seeping in.
Yeah.
How about your kids? Are you finding the same? Like being around like a Bitcoin dad?
No. My daughter is convinced that I need to grow the business into being a unicorn.
An actual unicorn.
Yeah. she understands what a billion means, and how many games on the Xbox and stuff that would equate to. But no, I don't push anything onto them. They probably know more about Bitcoin than most of their friends and family and other people and stuff. But I got to a point now where, like I say, you don't want to be that Bitcoin guy that's just constantly at people trying to tell them that this is the next big thing. It kind of wears you down. So being able to step away from work and separate family and work for me is absolutely critical for just my own well-being, really, to have those two parts of my life. But even though they always say, oh, you, Dad or Danny, you're just always on your phone, it's like, yeah, Twitter. Yeah. Just scrolling Twitter. I try not to engage too much time on it now, because you can just end up running around in circles with stupid people. Life is so much less stressful when you don't let things or people get you into a heated debate over 3 hours. That time can be spent so much more productively than arguing with somebody, which is generally an argument over language these days and terminology.
And everything's so like polarizing these days, right? If you were allowed down the pub, let's say you were allowed down the pub again and you went down, you met like 6 or 7 mates. You could, the conversation could bounce around so quickly and you could find yourself having the complete opposing view because of what Bitcoin has taught you about, like probably about like God knows how many different rabbit holes you've been down.
Why I struggle to ever call somebody an expert. Because there's so many different fundamental aspects to Bitcoin, whether it's be economics, computer science, distributed systems, applied cryptography, like networking, computer networking. We're even beyond the internet now, obviously, with satellite communication. And now, obviously, Starlink's being launched by SpaceX and things like that, which introduces like additional and then you've got, like the real, like for me, the real geniuses in the spaces, which are the people building things like Rodolfo over at CoinKite, who will play around, and I believe like Nick Szabo, play around with like radio frequency, like radio broadcasting, Bitcoin transactions and data and things like that. That for me, and like the MeshNet guys, GoTenor and all of the other like more open source solutions for MeshNets. Them, they're the real like geniuses for me that are building and developing, and the people that I like to look at and look to and stuff. But yeah, there's just so many different aspects. So for me, it's really hard to be an expert across them all. And I even tweeted the other day about, you know, I've been in Bitcoin, what, nearly nine, coming up probably even 10 years. Nine years. And I still struggle to find the words to truly describe it to the layman, because you can just go off on a tangent. Maybe I just need to work on my communication. I have people telling me it should be discussed like this and like this. And it's like, but you're doing that. And the first words that you used were factually incorrect. So no, I won't describe it like that. Like somebody called it unhackable. Well, there's a block in 2010 that kind of created billions of Bitcoin. So as part of an output, and the chain kind of got rolled back, and that whole issue seems to get like swept under the carpet by a lot of people that are trying to project this image of what Bitcoin is and mold it in their own eyes and their creation and impart that on other people. I just kind of don't really agree with that. So,
well, yeah, I don't know too much about that.
It's like a major factor, and it was a bug. It was a buffer overflow bug, and there's a timestamp bug. In about 80 or 90 years, Bitcoin will stop because there's a 32-bit integer, which is a software engineering problem where this timestamp is going to literally click over to zero because it can't get any bigger. And the next block after the previous block that's created after that requires, as part of the consensus rules, the next timestamp to be larger than the last one. But it's going to be zero or 1, 2, 3, 4, or wherever the time is. So Bitcoin is going to stop. We need to fix that problem. And there's far better people than me to talk about how that can be fixed. Can it be implemented as a soft fork? Or is it going to be requiring a hard fork and stuff like that? And like people like Luke Dash Jr., Peter Woolley, those are the type of people that are probably far better at answering those questions than me. So there's so many like cheerleaders, and for me, they're just hype. I just call them hype men that will just post all day about how great Bitcoin is and not actually look at any of the real problems that need addressing or even acknowledge them. So I just try to remain as level as I possibly can. You need to kind of stay away from Twitter to do that.
Yes. Yeah, true.
But I have been one of those people that told that was out and shouting that Bitcoin is the next best thing since sliced bread. I've been that person before. It's humbling over time.
Yeah, I'm not sure where I am right now. I'd have to ask my bunch of mates. Like, I'm at the point now where I'm getting more questions directed my way than ever before.
Yeah.
But I definitely just started toning it down. I mean, the whole reason I started the podcast was I just needed other people to talk to.
Yeah.
If you are out in a group of people and Bitcoin should come up, whatever, you know immediately whether or not that person actually is like down the rabbit hole and truly understands it, and you just feel a total gravitational pull towards them.
Yeah. Even what you also find is like, on social media and things, people can be the most combative, most disagreeable person going. But yet when you put them in a conference room together, they actually share so many things in common that even brought them into the space. That whereas if you was to think, these people, if these two, you wouldn't put these two people in the same room together because it would probably turn into a fight. When they actually sit down and talk, they're just having a laugh and a joke, and they generally, this is how I've always seen like it play out in conferences and stuff like that in the past, and hopefully it stays that way. But everybody in this space, one way or another, has been drawn into this space generally for the same kind of reasons. So you've already got like a fundamental understanding of like certain belief systems and stuff. That's probably going to shift as the space gets bigger and grows and away from that. It probably already has started. Well, we saw with the Bcash fork and everything, how all the salesmen went one way and all of the geeks, computer guys went the other way, or stayed on the same path, I should say. But yeah, it's definitely good to actually meet these people in person, especially if you disagree on social media and stuff.
Yeah, I've not done one of the conferences yet. I was hoping to this year, but you know, who knows when we'll be back allowed on planes. And
so you're based in south of France, right?
Yeah,
lucky you. Like for me, this whole lockdown and things like that, the sooner we can get back to some kind of like normality, the better. If people are just responsible for themselves, they're generally going to be a lot more cautious and stuff like for like infection prevention and stuff for other people. But if you're vulnerable, protect yourself. Just act in your own self-best interest. So
yeah, exactly, mate.
I need a holiday. That's what I need.
Let's go. You said something right at the beginning about the SpaceX and the Starlink satellites. Have you seen them go over?
Yes.
How unbelievable is that?
I've seen them go over post-launch. The last launch they did. They literally passed over the UK or the south half of the UK literally 30 minutes after launch, which was pretty cool. So we didn't see the whole chain, but we saw the stage two pass over. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's mad. Like the whole chain we just saw the other night. It was like, my God.
Really?
And this, unreal. Yeah,
I know you can track it online and see when it's going to be visible and stuff like that. I should probably look that up.
Yeah, your kids would love it.
Yeah, if I can get them off the Xbox at the moment.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So let's the usual kind of order of podcasts is, you know, the rabbit hole story and what brought you into Bitcoin and where you were at the time. And what can you share with us? Like right back. I mean, what was that day? It's like, huh? What is this Bitcoin thing?
For me, it's actually quite funny. I broke my hand on the back of somebody's head, which was kind of stupid. So I had my hand in pot and so I couldn't work, couldn't do anything. So I just sat at home, had to switch my mouse over to my left hand. That's all I can really truly remember was having to get used to using my desktop with my left-handed mouse using my left hand on the mouse. And just reading and just all sorts of random things that I was bored. And I couldn't even tell you the name of the blog that I was reading, but I kind of discovered it. It was like a financial blog, and because I think I had some bonds due for renewal, due for maturity, I should say, and it just fell into my life, and because I was bored, I had the time to just go get into it. Like everybody, what's this? Distributed. There's no central point of failure. Kind of understood what a central point of failure would mean for money and not having that, especially electronic money being unregulatable on a network level, because I was the first person in school with a CD writer. So the entrepreneurial spirit was there in school. And then, Napster, we used to have like Audio Galaxy and stuff, which was like websites where you could download the MP3s directly from the website. Before Napster was even a thing, for all of my old rap albums and used to do my mix CDs and stuff as well. Like back being like 14, 15 in school. And so, yeah, so I kind of understood the what it would mean for money, because I'd seen the file sharing path from like Audio Galaxy and websites all the way through like Napster, the failure of Napster, the music industry's reaction to Napster. And I'd worked in retail banking straight out of school as well. So understood that money wasn't backed by anything and stuff. And I, for me, one of the greatest speakers on Bitcoin, especially from an economics perspective, is Tur de Meister. He came over to Cyprus and stuff and wrote a blog piece about me and what everything that happened in Cyprus at that time, which I'm pretty sure we'll cover. But even to this day, his early talks on Bitcoin are just absolutely phenomenal for making that penny drop as to what it's really capable of from an economics perspective. Censorship resistance and everything else like that is, well, censorship resistance is literally the key selling point of Bitcoin. Not saying that censorship resistance in the form of darknet markets or anything like that, but censorship resistance, if it's mine, it's mine. Like, not your keys, not your coins. Come and take it from me. I've not even got any. that boating accident was terrible. So, yeah, that for me is just why Bitcoin is our only hope going forward, or our biggest hope.
Yes, our biggest hope for sure. It's funny you bring up Tur, because he was one of the first people that I saw on Real Vision talking about Bitcoin. And yeah, you're right. He has a, I can't even remember exactly what he said, but it was just like, one, I couldn't believe how young this guy was talking complete
sense. He looks younger than what he is, trust.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, he's definitely looked after himself then. But it was, yeah, it's, and still to this day, you know, he's still on top of his game.
Absolutely. It's incredible. And for me, he communicates it so brilliantly. And there was one video, can't remember from when, it's probably from 2012, maybe even before. And he was saying about if just the black market economy, like the shadow economy, if that like 5% of the black market economy filters into Bitcoin, like the value of Bitcoin. And then only like when it was put into those kind of, or framed in that way, did I personally truly get the nature of it. But before that, it was just like a niche, pretty cool thing for firing value across the internet.
Right. So you mentioned Cyprus.
Yeah.
You were out there. So yeah, what was the path after school then? You touched on retail banking. So
yeah, I was a nightmare at school. The way that I
literally, entrepreneurs generally are, right?
On reflection, I was probably far more disruptive than I'd like to have been. I came away from school with good enough grades and things like that. But the way that I learn is I can read something and I can generally remember it. And if I'm interested, I'll generally remember it and be able to recall it and apply it contextually. but I couldn't get into sixth form or college because of my school report. To be honest with you, I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to have taught me either. I got banned off the school's computers because I removed all of my own internet restrictions on the first lot of computers that had internet access at school. So I remember some rather risque photos being printed off, and there was five of us marched into the headmistress's office with these printouts on her desk saying, "How have you done this?" And then she told the other four to leave. And then the head of the council's IT department came in and screamed at me, "How did you do it?" So I kind of had to explain. But then I was just banned off the computers at school permanently.
How did you know how to do that young?
My stepfather was essentially a computer nerd. I tinkered. I literally remember selling, I put together a little bit of an online business selling, I don't know if you can remember, the Nokia 3210 and the 3310, the ringtones and the custom screensavers, which was like a bitmap, like images for screensavers and wallpapers on the old Nokia 3210 bricks, and selling them so people could like text the premium number and stuff. And I had the printouts when you could, in the magazines, you would see the things, but I did that at school and stuff like that. So just tinkering and learning and reading old boards and things like that. I wouldn't really promote my kids to do it now, but yeah, so we had no internet restrictions at school where everybody else did. So boys being boys. Yeah, that was fun and games. So I couldn't get into college or sixth form. So I moved away because I had some quite tearaway friends. So my mum sent me to live with my grandparents. applied for a job in a bank because I was working for my grandparents' company, which I'd later come back to grow and prepare for sale. And we sold the business for them, which enabled them to retire. But that was only a temporary thing whilst I looked for something more interesting that I wanted to really do. So I applied for a job at a bank, got my first job interview, walked in confident, probably a little bit overconfident to be fair, knowing me at that time. Absolutely smashed the interview. Found out when I got the job that I was the youngest ever employee of the bank, straight out of school. I still had my curtains and my undercut. I found out after my interview that the manager was the most notorious manager in the region. And she walked downstairs and she literally told the entire team, "I've just had a 16-year-old in for an interview that's just done better than all of you you ever did in your interviews." So I worked in retail banking, discovered that money is a fraud.
Right. What was your job there?
On the retail? I literally started out as a 16-year-old behind the counter. Within 6 months, I was training to be a personal financial consultant. This was when the FSA was around. And I literally done all of the courses and everything for being a personal financial consultant for the more wealthy clients of the bank. But I wasn't 18, so I couldn't get licensed by the FSA. So I was just waiting. I kind of got bored in the job. Really should have like stuck it out, but left there and moved to HSBC. Kind of got bored of banking, retail banking. It's not investment banking, where all the big money is earned. So left and. Literally went into one of the family businesses, like with my grandparents, back to where I literally went as a stop off between like school and getting a job for the bank. And then from there, built that, or just structured everything so we could sell the company, which enabled them to retire. And then moved into another one of the family businesses, which was in the security industry. That was going through like regulatory upheaval at the time. And then pretty much discovered Bitcoin.
Right.
I also like made some other like investments and stuff in other like enterprises and stuff like before that time. Learned some lessons, got burnt in some, made some money in others, nothing too major. And then I say discovered Bitcoin. Moved to Cyprus in 2012 because my daughter. My daughter's mother was married to somebody in the RAF, got posted to Akrotiri in Cyprus. So I wanted to give my daughter that opportunity to experience another culture and everything. So I didn't want to deny her of that. And I could just up and move and work from anywhere. So I did that. So I just moved over to Cyprus. Then the bail-ins happened. The where the banks literally haircut 50% of everything over 100,000 euros in everybody's accounts. The original plan was 8% of everything over 1,000 euros, but that was going to cause violence. Somebody that's got 1,200 euros in their account is going to feel any loss more than somebody that's got 250,000 euros. And I think it was aimed at taxing the Russian money that was sat in Cyprus, but the Russian money left for Malta months before. I think they got tipped off. But the whole scenario, I was living in the Bitcoin bubble. So I was hearing all this, it's a perfect like storm. And I was at the time thinking Bitcoin is perfect for this. People, if people held Bitcoin, they wouldn't be going through this. So did some research into the market and stuff, and the way in which people are in Cyprus, they don't like to deviate too much away from what they normally do. So we thought, okay, build out physical locations. So it's the same as like going to a bank, the same type of interactions that they're used to having and stuff. How wrong was I? the business was, we was innovating with like multi-sig wallets, like really like back when multi-sig was like literally nascent.
What year was this?
2013.
2013. Wow. So when they did the bail-ins in Cyprus, could you just feel like what was the shift in like just?
See, if you read the media that I was reading at the time, you would have thought everybody on the ground was running into Bitcoin. There's the first Bitcoin ATM in Cyprus. Bitcoin's gonna become like take over in Cyprus. It's the perfect scenario for Bitcoin. So you kind of had that. But then on the other hand, you was like, no, people are queuing up to get 60 euros or 100 euros out of the ATM to ensure that they can feed their family because the banks are shut. People aren't and can't move vast sums of wealth into Bitcoin because the banks have closed their doors.
And what was the feel on the street between like the general population?
Nobody knew what Bitcoin was. Nobody.
But just like everyday life where people, it must have been tangible, right? Like people are losing their wealth and they have no idea what's happening tomorrow.
Well, there was a lot of uncertainty, but life just went on. As long as you could feed your family and you had access to some capital, people were fine just continuing on. Yeah, sure, there was some unrest and stuff when they was first discussing, because the banks closed and they hadn't decided what the final situation was going to be when they closed the banks to prevent that run. Nobody knew anything really. It was just up in the air and there was lots of speculation about what was actually going to happen and stuff like that. So people was just getting on the best they could. The underlying issue was people was borrowing in Cyprus, investing in Greek bonds that was offering a high return. All of those Greek bonds got defaulted on. None of the lending got paid back because the income had stopped. So they was like literally playing the borrowing low, investing for high returns, merry-go-round, and that merry-go-round stopped. And that's when all of the the bail-ins and everything had happened. So in a way, it was the behaviours of the people in Cyprus that was doing this, borrowing that money to invest. But in a way, the banks was also promoting that as a good thing to do that would never come to an end. Like the good times would never end because Greece wouldn't default on their bonds and stuff.
An all too familiar story.
Yeah.
Wow. So what did you start building then in Cyprus?
We actually built the first location, physical branch. It was absolutely beautiful. I don't know if you've seen images of it, but it in Nicosia. Our offices was in Nicosia above where the branch was in a brand new building. I basically, if I could go back, I would do so much different. We raised capital from within the Bitcoin community and stuff. Like pre-ICO days, it was like the wrong 100%, so many wrong decisions that I made. And it was me that was making the decisions. It was me that was choosing the people that was around the company influencing decisions. So the book 100% stops here. And so much went wrong. And then it all exploded. I literally had to go quiet for the best part of coming up to like 3 years when I could break my silence. I fought extradition. I had threats made against my family. There was people that made false accusations against me that offered for all of the issues to go away if I signed over all the assets of the company. We was innovating with like multi-sig wallets to enable the user to hold one key, we would hold another. We had a card payment network that was developing of our own that was linked to the Bitcoin wallets. And we also had other bits and pieces that we was working on as well. But ultimately, we spread ourselves too thin, and some of the people was just wrong that got involved with the company. But again, it was all my decisions. So,
so you said you were fighting extradition. What this time you were in the UK, yeah. And like the business started
No. I lived in Cyprus from 2012. Right. I'd literally just paid up 12 months on my house. I've moved into a new property in Nicosia to be closer to the offices because Tur came over and spoke at two of our conferences.
Right.
And he wrote in this expose article basically what him and Andreas did, because Andreas was an advisor to the company that we was paying. I'd spoke to him about three times. It was somebody else that worked for me that wanted him on board that was a friend of his for help for the development guys. And they wrote article or blog posts about me that basically like Tur said, oh, my house was like practically empty. I'd literally moved into it. So the night before, I was putting together the furniture for the spare room at like 5 a.m. And I picked him up from the airport at like 7, 8 a.m. At the same time, I was trying to launch Neo and the business, and we had these conferences and stuff like that. So I was just like, whatever. I've got bigger problems than like refuting things like that. But ultimately, they was just protecting themselves, and I've got no problem with them doing that. Throw me under the bus. I made enough bad decisions to warrant being thrown under the bus. There was lots of like rampant and wild speculation. Like me and Mark Parles was sat on an island somewhere sipping pina coladas with all of these bitcoins. And it's like, no, yeah, it's not. Ultimately, not what happened. I literally came back to the UK for 5 days. I had some meetings with planned with an investor. And the next thing you know, there's an arrest warrant being issued for me. And it took me 11 months to find out what was in that warrant. And when I did find out, I burst out laughing.
What was it?
The accusations was absolutely crazy. One of them, I think three of the accusations were fraud, uttering a false document, and obtaining goods under false pretenses. Oh, and money laundering, and there was an accusation of theft. But pretty much around that, and like one of them was about this contract that had a company name that was written as Limited, LTD, on the end of a company name, and that company hadn't been formatted on the date of that contract, the date that was on the contract. And they basically said that I misled this person into believing that this company was a limited company and it was registered and what have you. About a year later, when I finally got interviewed by the Cypriot police in London at the embassy, after they dropped the warrant and stuff and they wanted to close everything down, I was thrilled to be able to produce the fact that I hadn't actually written that contract, and I had the emails of me sending that contract back stating that that company isn't limited yet, and things like that. And that's just one of the mild accusations that was funny.
So what led to all this? Like, was there just like a bit of a breakdown in the business, and then like investors wanted their cash back? Or
no,
like,
it weren't even it? That. It was basically
what was the business called?
Neon B.
Neon B.
Yeah.
Right.
I did an interview recently with Charlie Shrem that covered a lot of it off. But ultimately, investors lost money after the fact because the business and everything collapsed when all of this was going on. But ultimately, what I put it down to is these individuals were requesting me to sign over all of the assets from everything that was created to them in exchange for dropping all of these allegations. Cyprus has got a population of just under 1 million people in the south, the southern part of Cyprus. Every man and his dog is related. And this warrant was going through the UK judiciary system at Westminster Magistrates, which is where all of the terrorists and everybody like goes. People may have seen it when they've been looking at Julian Assange's cases and things. Assange was quoted in my arguments against being extradited. His case was cited in my defense. It was just absolute like madness. I was on electronic tag for 3 months to prove that I wasn't going to leave the country. So I had a curfew. I've never, ever been tried or even charged with a crime in my entire life. But I still went through that whole extradition proceeding. So my life was on hold. I couldn't commit to anything. After 11 months of extradition proceedings, bearing in mind this is supposed to take 10 days under the European arrest warrant thing to make a decision. 11 months later, I randomly got an email saying that they've dropped the warrant out of the blue. The warrant has been dropped. Right from the beginning, there's a provision in the Extradition Act where if it's an accusation warrant, you can making an arrangement to be questioned in the country where you're at by the law enforcement agents of the country that's trying to extradite you. So we was making this, and they was adamant, no, we want you here, we're going to hold you on remand whilst we question you for a maximum period of 7 days. So, and then we'll decide what we're going to do after those 7 days in our courts. So I was fighting to stay in the UK because the stories and stuff, part of the, I heard some of the statements was being twisted and changed when people was interviewed about me with the police and stuff. It just stunk to high heaven. And now there's a girl that was part of a rape accusation case in Cyprus, and she's been saying, oh, the police was changing, like they changed what I said, they twisted what I said, and things like that. And she literally got sentenced for complaining that she was gang raped in Iron Apple. And it's like, do you know what? It sounds so similar. But she's back in the UK now, and they literally held her in prison and stuff and tried her for making these false accusations, that because it would make them look bad if that had happened to somebody in Iron Apple. Yeah, after 11 months, they literally turned around, dropped this warrant and said, we'll come to London, we'll interview you, but you can't have a lawyer.
What?
Yeah. literally got emails stating like the exchange. I was like, okay, so my lawyer will be present. I want my Cypriot lawyer and my UK lawyer. Oh, no, you can't have any lawyer. From what I can gather and a little bit of research, there was a bit of an investigation in the economics crimes unit of the Cypriot police, and there was loads of corruption exposed. And basically the people that was making these accusations were extremely well connected. Put it that way. I can't prove it, but the people that know who they are would know exactly like the level of integration into politics and everything, to the point of one of them has the ex-president over for tea. And when we was over there, these people was helping us when it suited, and they was helping us make a massive impact and stuff. And some of them I really looked up to, others not so much. So, it was just one hell of a mess. So I ended up being interviewed in the Cypriot embassy in London for 5 hours. I recorded it on my phone. I couldn't have a lawyer present, but I recorded it on my phone purely for the fact that if they want to try and extradite me again, I can prove they won't have my or give me my human rights of representation and everything. So I have a solid defense when it comes to trying to extradite me to Cyprus ever again. By the end of this interview, I turned around and said to them, what would you do if I was in my position? And he said, if it cost us as much money as what these have clearly cost you and everybody else, I'd sue them. I'd see them in court. That was from the police.
Way.
Yeah. The police.
No
like,
way.
If you're ever in Cyprus, just come and see us. We'd love to talk to you. Just shoot the shit basically on like over a coffee to talk about Bitcoin and everything. Like, you're always welcome. They couldn't have been nicer in the end. And these people was like adamant that they wanted me over there. They was going to hold me on remand. And then after this interview, they said, we know it's going to get closed. This case will be closed. You'll hear from the Attorney General to say that it's been closed. It took them 3 months nearly to actually send the confirmation that the case was closed. Yeah.
Nah.
And part of me thinks if I'd have been over there and it took them 3 months to close the account, close the case, would I have been on remand in Cypriot prison that's overpopulated for 3 months for absolutely nothing, or for getting making some bad decisions about who I had around the other bad decisions that I was making at the time?
So for the best part of the year, you were like waking up every day just not knowing whether there was going to be like a squad car at the door.
There was two. It was about a year and a half where that was the case. When they actually came and knocked on my door, bearing in mind when all the newspaper articles came out, I took myself to the police station and said, look, the Daily Mail's written this about me.
was there an ounce of truth in it?
In the Daily Fail, it made absolutely no sense. They talked about my the Bentley driving Britain abroad.
Nice.
As absconded with €70,000. It's like, my car is worth more than the amount of money. I've just paid my rent for 12 months in Nicosia, which if you add all of that, my dogs are sat in kennels. And everybody that knows me knows that, like, my dogs and my children – yeah, the kids are only just a hard joke, but my dogs mean everything to me, and literally my entire life was still in Cyprus. My daughter was still in Cyprus, and the Daily Mail was saying that I'd absconded, this, that, and the other. But the Daily Mail online, where it was published, is registered in America, so you kind of can't sue them for defamation.
Did any other papers pick up on it?
The problem was two of the people that was making accusations was part of arguably the biggest PR agency in Cyprus. So All of the local papers turned all of our marketing around into from Who is Neo, which was the tagline of the marketing campaign, into Where is Neo? And basically, a lot of the press stuff that was ran, it was run from an angle. Information that people was given and was from the person inside that was making threats against my daughter. So all of the information, even information disseminated amongst Bitcoiners, was all being driven. Even like when employees made social media posts about how bad and wrong I was. It was all from a certain person, an angle, which made me the baddie in the situation. It's like, yeah, I was the baddie in the situation, but not in that way. I was the one that was making decisions and made wrong decisions. Even in handling it, how I handled it, like when all of this was going on, was probably not the best way to handle it. But I didn't go to prison for crimes that I didn't commit. So I'm happy with that. With that fact that I don't have that over me. But
so you've seen like the FUD machine up close and personal, like far too up close and personal.
Yeah. So I take literally everything. It made me very aware of the, what's it called? The Murray Gell-Mann amnesia effect. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Within the media, people give the media some level of authority that is unwarranted. A journalist is a journalist. They have to write about many different things, unless they have a specialist subject. Then, basically, if you really know, if you're an expert of a topic, or you have a really high level understanding of a deep level of understanding of a topic, you can read a media article and you think that's absolute rubbish. Like, printing money is good. But you know that. So you think, oh, that's absolutely rubbish. Turn the page over. Oh, this war on Iraq, you don't understand geopolitics and things like that. So the information that you're provided in the next article from another journalist, you accept as fact, but you've forgotten the previous journalist that was writing about the thing that you understand actually doesn't know very much, and their understanding is incorrect, and how they've presented it is just wrong. And for me, that kind of just validated that.
Like, the state of the media in the UK is like at all time lows.
Yeah. You only have to look at this Dominic Cummings guy.
He may have
been absolutely stupid. Fair enough. But there's the media are baying for his blood, and they're all stood outside the front of his house in one big crowd complaining at the fact that he was not social distancing or whatever. But for me, all politicians have an impossible job of keeping however many millions of people happy. So they're either stupid or genius for getting paid for trying to achieve an impossible job. It's just like rank hypocrisy. And you just kind of have to gather facts for yourself these days. Even videos presented online and stuff like that, you have to kind of make sure that you've got the full context, because a 30-second video clip can make somebody look really bad. But you may have missed the 25 minutes of goading or physical abuse or verbal abuse that's preceded that one person retaliating, and they're the one that they're the one that looks bad then, and stuff like that. So people do take.
But we lap up those 20-second clips, right? Because we're so busy, we're so fast scrolling through.
Yeah.
If we see a Karen, like, yelling at someone in a shopping aisle, we think that's the full story right there. Yeah. But like you say, somebody might be in there needling them to that point to try and get some kind of viral clip.
Yeah. And you can even edit. You can record the whole 3 minutes, but you can edit the 30 seconds on your phone. And you can frame anything these days to look and appear. And this is what's going to happen when all of this COVID stuff blows over. One side's going to pull these numbers and another side's going to pull these numbers from a data set. And whatever validates their position and their bias and everything, they're just going to argue from that. And both will have a case. And they'll make a case look presentable. And one side will accept that side and then reject the other side. And it's just the way.
Meanwhile, all of this BS is playing out. We're just sitting here quietly stacking sets.
That's all you can do, really. And that's like about everything, it's like everything that went on with me with Cyprus and stuff. I had a year away from my daughter, whilst it was all going on. She was still in Cyprus. I couldn't go back to Cyprus. And the it was either let it break me. I was 100% in a depressed state for that period of time. Probably didn't see it at the time. But I said to myself, what have I spent the most money on in the last, say, decade of my life? What do I want to do now? It was either become a lawyer or the law does interest me. I love a good debate. I'll argue any side. I sometimes take the contrarian position just for the fun of it, for throwing a hand grenade into a social situation if it gets a bit boring. But the other one was software development and how I was when I was younger and stuff like that. So I literally just started reteaching myself how to code and everything, and just started iterating out. I was playing around with OpenBazaar when that had just launched and stuff. Just improving. We had one idea for the company in Cyprus, and that was to develop Neo EasyCoin. We had the domain easyco.in. It was essentially to become the Charlie Shrem's company, Bit Instant of Europe, basically. So I thought we can do that even better now. Like with hindsight, I could do that better. So I started iterating out, bought the domain bethebank.com, reached out to the FCA. So could we get a special dispensation to use the name bank in our domain, even though we're not a bank? They declined. So we bought fastbitcoins.com. I literally built and wrote every line of code myself whilst on bail and everything to develop fastbitcoins.com. I met Obi from CoinFloor in Manchester at CoinFest, which is a free Bitcoin / altcoin shitcoin event. But everybody goes, and the Bitcoiners are the Bitcoiners, and I end up arguing with all the shitcoiners, telling them how they don't need their own token. We sat down and we spoke for a good couple of hours. I think he took as much from the conversation as I did. And it's great to see the path that he's been on since we met. But he said to me, you're going to need to trust people again. I just built all of this and it hadn't launched or anything. And I turned around and spoke to a couple of the bigger backers of like Neo and stuff, and just explained to them, this is what I've built. Are you interested and what have you? And they came on board, and they're now my co-founders for Fast Bitcoins. They've been like a instrumental part of the business. Somebody that used to work at Neo, so things can't have been that bad, now works for Fast Bitcoins. And it's going great guns. And it's literally the name of the holding company is AAO, for Against All Odds.
So Against All Odds, I mean, yeah, if you were... I mean, a day could have made a difference here, right? 5 or 6 hours could have made a difference. You could have ended up in prison for like a long time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
For nothing.
37 like, years they was trying to throw at me for these crimes.
All right. So let's say that you spent a year in prison.
How do you get that time back?
Well, one, how do you get the time back? But what does that do to you mentally? I know you said you were on Charlie's show. I'm going to have to go back and listen to that because his story just fascinates me as well.
I think he would put his hand away. He'll put his hands up. I probably don't agree with everything that he does now, with everything that he does. But do you know what? He built something in this space. And anybody that does that has my respect. Somebody that's built something that's not just purely designed to separate people from their bitcoins, but to actually generate some type of value in the space, 100% has my respect. Whether they succeed or fail, Yeah, they've definitely got my respect because there's so many people that will put people down and what have you, but it's the builders that's going to take this and make this available to everybody and for Bitcoin to fulfill any of its potential.
Yeah, exactly. So explain Fast Bitcoins to us then. What's the premise behind it and what are you building out?
Okay, so I've always thought people, the retail user, the man on the street, the woman on the street, to insert whatever gender you want on the street, needs a quick and simple way of just getting a bit of Bitcoin. I'm not really interested in dealing with your investment bankers and your high frequency traders and stuff like that. Just the average Joe.
The average Joe doesn't want to be bothered to open an exchange account, right?
Exactly.
If you say to people, just open an exchange account, they're like, they glaze over. You're like, what are you even saying? I don't know what you mean. And I feel
stupid. What's
all
these order types? What's all of these candles? What's all of these charts? It's what's an order book? It's all extremely, intimidating for the average person. You also got to remember that the average person really doesn't care about Bitcoin. But there's many of them that will care about the number going up. And if they can discover Bitcoin trying to get a little bit richer or whatever, then so be it. If every cyclical event that we go through, if just, say, 1 to 10% of those people stick around for the movement, that's going to compound over time and it's just going to grow and grow and grow. And it's not on me to say who can and can't use Bitcoin. So if it's retail, if it's the big money, the institutions, it's not on me to say you can and can't use Bitcoin. That's the beauty of Bitcoin. Sure, people with a lot of money are going to be able to accumulate more Bitcoin than most people. But as long as people have some Bitcoin, it gives them strength in the face of the money that is centrally controlled by their government. So it doesn't matter. And that's who, like with Fast Bitcoins, the idea is ultimately to put a little bit of Bitcoin in a billion people's wallets, one way or another. And we're trying to do that in the most best principled way. Like we're non-custodial. We now offer like dollar cost averaging. We can, we've got an affiliate like referral scheme. So people can earn Bitcoins by bringing customers to us, by bringing merchants to us to enable us to grow our retail networks and stuff. So we're trying to just basically create as many Bitcoiners as we possibly can.
So for any really new people listening to this, when you say like we're non-custodial, could you just like really make that clear for what you mean by that?
Okay. If you do not control your Bitcoin, as in the keys to your Bitcoin, they are not your Bitcoin, not your keys, not your coins. So what we do as a company is we'll sell you those Bitcoins and we require to deliver them to you as soon as you've purchased them from us. You can't store them with us. We must send them to you. We was the first cash to lightning exchange in the world. So you could you can go into one of our retail partners that's got a convenience store or a store near you, buy one of our vouchers, and then redeem it and receive delivery on the Lightning Network and things like that. We're about to add Liquid as well for any traders that want to get in and move funds into an exchange on Liquid without having to wait for larger on-chain transactions and stuff. But even now, the language that I'm using is probably far too advanced.
I was gonna say,
for the end user.
If I'm just a guy that's listened to a few pods and I'm thinking, that's great. They keep talking about exchanges. They keep talking about non-custodial and they keep talking like, how can I just walk into a shop and hand over some cash and get some Bitcoin back in like some kind of wallet? And that's what you guys are essentially doing, right?
No, it's almost like that. So we do have some wallets where we're directly integrated into. So you can redeem one of our vouchers inside the wallet interface, like the inside the actual wallet itself, and we'll just deliver it straight into there. We've got some more wallets coming online, but Samurai, Breeze Wallet, which is a Lightning wallet, and we've got a couple of others that we're working on and towards like direct integration. So you'll be able to go and buy a voucher denominated right, so in pounds or phone, euros.
If I've got a phone with Samurai,
yeah,
and I'm in the UK and I walk into a news agent and I need a pint of milk for the missus and I'm not going to buy the Daily Fail, but I might, you know, I might pick myself up something else. And there's a point of sale machine at the counter that says sell Bitcoin, or like it might have your sign on it, Fast Bitcoin.
Yeah, there'll be posters around the store.
I could hand over £20.
Yeah,
and ask, what's the guy going to do? He's going to print out like
he's
going to
print out £20 Fast Bitcoin voucher,
right?
Which will have,
and it'll have a QR code.
Or? Yeah, a QR code, right. And the text code as well. Which you can then redeem either through fastbitcoins.com directly through your account there, or if you've linked your wallet to your Fast Bitcoins account, you'll scan the QR code and it'll just deliver £20 worth of Bitcoin to your wallet.
That easy?
Yeah.
So, right, I've got a phone, I've got a Samurai, I've gone onto fastbitcoins.com, I've opened an account.
Yeah.
Then I go to the newsagent or local store or petrol garage or whatever, and I see Fast Bitcoins accepted here. I can literally hand over £20. They give me off a printed receipt.
Yeah.
I take a snapshot. I go to the wallet, open the wallet, QR scan, code reader, yeah. And there's 20 quid's worth of Bitcoin in my Samurai wallet.
It will tell you how much you're going to get. You confirm that you want that much. You accept that amount. It's deliver it straight into your wallet.
Doesn't get much easier, right? This is for the masses now.
It's not, because the interfaces really? And stuff. No, I don't think so. I think we're still way, way, way off. I'm probably one of the few people that would actually say that. I still think we can improve as a company, our flows and stuff. We've had to adjust a lot because of the regulatory environment and things. So we've had to put our big boy pants on. And jump into bed with the regulators that be. Otherwise, they will send me to jail for operating a business like this and stuff. But
is this to do with the anti-money laundering law directive?
This is directed at the people that want to clearly fund some organisation that the government don't like with 20, 30, 40, 50 pound a month when they're stacking bitcoins. But ultimately, we have to abide by the laws until we can afford to buy our own politicians to change those laws.
I've got a smile on the face.
But I think we'll get to a point where we have saturation. It's not going to be an overnight success. We're only 10, 11 years in. Into what was an experiment. I don't think it's really an experiment now.
And for people listening to the show, where can they find your machines? Are you all over the UK or into Europe as well?
Yeah, we've got locations in Canada, the UK. We're still not everywhere, but we're a completely bootstrap company. We have no outside investment yet. We're in Estonia. We've got a location in Riga because somebody... someone from the company went to the Baltic Honey Badger conference here and sold it to a local computer shop or sold the idea. So we've got a location in Riga, Estonia. We're just getting registered with AusTrac in Australia. So it's going to start rolling out there. We've got a distribution agreement in Uganda, Togo, Ghana, and Madagascar.
So if I understand, it's not as if you're actually you're not providing the machines, that you're just providing the software that is downloaded on
point of sale. We provide the piece of hardware, the software that is on the device. We manage all of that remotely. It all gets updated over the air. We provide the retailer with a credit account, so they're literally zero risk for the merchant. They don't even have to know what Bitcoin is to be able to start generating revenues from this. We've got merchants in the UK that are earning up to like £2,000 a week in revenue. £2,000 a month in extra revenue just by offering our services. And one of the through having this network of hardware of our own, we can literally put anything we want onto these devices. So one of the bolt-ons that that I developed for fun was like a point-of-sale payment processing on the Lightning Network. So all of our merchants can accept Lightning payments. Our merchants can receive commissions in their local currency, or we have a stacking sats mode for merchants. So any of their revenues are generated and stored in Bitcoin, and they can just withdraw that Bitcoin from us whenever they wish. What have you. So,
right, cool. Right. Lots of business questions now. So, because this is fascinating me.
Not bad for a college dropout.
Yeah.
That built it whilst on bail.
Yeah, exactly. built it with an electronic ankle brace on, you know, whilst people are like, you know, baying for blood and all kinds of like
telling
nonsense.
Telling me to hang myself. Yeah.
Oh, mate. So, to scale the business now, what is the most important side? The who do you need to adopt? Like the merchants or the users? Or is it 50-50? What's the...
It's 50-50. The payment processing side is just a bolt-on. We don't expect to do too much volume or anything. It's there, but we're adding electronic payments as well. So people will be able to deposit to us using their bank accounts in Europe, possibly the UK. We'll see if we can get everything lined up how we want in Australia and Canada. The African countries where we're going to be operating in will predominantly be cash for now. So it is a case of both users, and I want to grow out our merchant network so people don't have to question, have you got a Fast Bitcoins location near you? They're just going to assume it because we have that depth of penetration of local retailers. We can also work with larger chains because we can integrate directly into their existing like point of sale systems. So they can generate our vouchers and handle deposits and things through an integration with us like that. But then we can also deal with like more independent and smaller chains by giving them our own hardware as well. So, and then we've just literally relaunched everything because all of like the compliance and the just improving the flows, and I can still make it a good 30% better for the end user, I feel. So over the coming month and a half, we should see even more improvements to the flow of how everything works, and even improving like the dollar cost averaging service that we offer and stuff to make that even better. We also introduced like something called a drip order, which basically takes like a voucher, cuts it up over a 24-hour period, and just executes an order every 10 minutes until it's filled. So you basically averaged out. So you stack those stats throughout the 24-hour period, then you receive delivery at the end. So people trying to get people to disconnect from the emotional investment into the price that they've bought at as much as possible, because then people hopefully panic a little bit less and what have you. So
how does like the business model work out? So if I'm a merchant and I start using fastbitcoins.com, I'm assuming I get X amount of the commission.
Yeah.
And X amount of, yeah. I mean, how does that whole process? I mean, obviously you're growing a business, you know, we expect you to be taking a fee. Of course, that would be mad if not. And where are you getting the Bitcoins from? Are you like attached to a certain exchange where
we have, liquidity providers that we're essentially plugged into an API level. So we execute our trades as and when we need to. So we access liquidity that way. But from the merchant's perspective, we for cash, any cash transactions now, we charge like a flat 4% fee. On average, the merchant earns like 2% of that. If we have two models now for the merchants, so if we provide you with a credit account, we pay, say, 2% interest. If you prepay, so you basically have a, say, if you've prepaid a £500, you can sell £500 worth of vouchers, but we'll pay you, say, 3% commission because you've prepaid and we've not had to take any credit risk and stuff like that. But most of our merchants have a credit account, zero risk to them. We burden all of that risk that they're going to pay once they've sold the vouchers and stuff. So that's the merchant side of things. And we're not actually directly linked to any single exchange. We have our local banking relationships where we have merchants because the merchants pay us electronically, and then we move those funds into our liquidity providers to obtain the best possible price in the market for when we're replenishing the stock that we're selling to them.
Man, that's a complicated, it's amazing what you've built. I think it's awesome. There's a lot of moving parts there that you've thought very, very carefully about.
Yeah, and then we have to add in all of the compliance side and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we've tried to automate as much as possible. We've got some safeguarding measures in now that just basically try to ensure that users aren't being scammed and ripped off when they're first using us. Because we have seen that, unfortunately, being the case where, go and buy some Bitcoins. You can get some locally from you from here, and then you can send them to us because we're offering you this amazing investment opportunity and stuff. So we ask some questions that aren't too invasive when a user first uses us and completes the first order, because we would like to try and stop as much of that as possible, because ultimately that person that gets scammed is going to think twice next time they come across Bitcoin, and they're going to associate Bitcoin in that negative context. So we've got to try and do our bit because that does happen, unfortunately.
Mm. I'm just thinking now in my mind, like in major cities, certainly around the UK, you have the, like if we use London as example, you have the Santander Cycle things. I mean, is that like, could you get your point of sale in those machines that are all over London? And because they print out the exact QR code, so you could take a bike for 2 hours, right?
Yeah,
you could buy Bitcoin at the same time.
We actually have some rickshaws in Glasgow.
Really?
The pedal rickshaws, yeah, where the riders have our device. They've hotspotted it to their phone. And you can buy the vouchers from the rickshaw riders. And you can even pay them using Lightning, obviously.
Wow.
And we've had them about a year now, probably a little bit longer as well. So, yeah.
So that is moving in that direction.
So we don't allow just individuals that are what you would say like traditional, like local Bitcoin traders have our devices and give them a credit account, this, that, and the other, because there's personal safety considerations and stuff. Whereas somebody with a fixed retail location, they've already got existing things in place to ensure that they're not going to get robbed or attacked. It's part of their existing business. It's just like an addition to their existing infrastructure. It's not somebody that's just going to go meet somebody in a car park randomly to sell them 20, 50, 100 pounds, 500 pounds worth of Bitcoin through us. So we are trying to avoid that for now in this model that we're doing business.
Mate, that's awesome. Really, incredible work.
Thanks. It's all we can do is just keep moving forward, trying to improve and improve and improve.
100%, man. 100%. Hats off to you. I think what a crazy journey. What an incredible story. Like, it's you must look back like and think, shit. Like, you know, the amount you must have learned throughout this whole, like, you know, there's got to be an upside. Obviously, there's always an upside to, you know.
Yeah, I was expecting the first question of the evening to be, what is Bitcoin to you? Because that is quite a common one that I've heard on your podcast.
Right.
And I was about, I'd already pre-thought about it as humbling. Right. Bitcoin is extremely humbling. I'm also getting older. And the only thing, somebody from Vietnam yesterday, from Bitcoin VN, the founder there said to me yesterday, the only thing as scarce as the sats that we stack is the days that we have on this planet. Yeah. And do you know what? That is so true. Funny enough, thinking about that on today of all days for me personally, it is so true. Don't think you know it all. Learn from the mistakes that have been made in the past by like myself and stuff. If I'd not made all of these mistakes, I'd probably be sat on thousands of Bitcoins, living on a yacht already. I've still got to do a lot of work before I get back to potentially ever living that lifestyle.
Stay away from boats, Danny. They're no good.
Oh, boats, you know what?
Boats are not good for your wealth.
I'm from a fishing family originally. Like, the history of apparently in the family tree, William Brewster was one of the pilgrims that left on the Mayflower for America. Sailing the seas is in the blood, and it can also put me as far away from people as possible. and with Starlink, we can have. I was actually speaking to somebody that's been testing these low Earth orbit internet connectivity down in the Arctic on research vessels, and they say like the speed and the ping and everything is just out of this world, especially on like a large ship for what they're used to. You say it's epic. He loves working with it and stuff. So yeah, maybe one day when the big exit is done and, I'd have a floating citadel happily. but I do want to get everybody settled, like just repaid and stuff that backed Neo and stuff in Cyprus. And that's part of why I'm doing what I do and stuff, because they took a risk back in the startup and stuff, but it didn't kind of go to plan, and they shouldn't have lost out in the way that they lost out. So I feel like the ultimate responsibility there to get those guys settled, and lasses and ladies. So yeah, we'll get there, but it's just hard work.
Let's hope so, man.
I'm not the smartest, so anybody can build anybody.
Yeah, that's a good message. That's a great message. Well, you probably know how we're in the show. So, if there was one person you could implant your knowledge into that you've learned about Bitcoin and all of the lessons that you've learned along the way, that would then go and share that message with their audience, an audience far wider than you could ever imagine, and influence and educate about Bitcoin, who would that person be and why?
Either President of the US or maybe the Prime Minister of the UK, or of one of the Chancellor of the German, the Chancellor of Germany, one of the larger economies, the first leader that's a maximalist. Go and tell your central bank that we're going on to a Bitcoin standard, because it's going to separate us from the rest of the world, and it's going to allow us to probably get invaded pretty quickly by the US. but yeah, just somebody that has worked themselves into that type of position that can make those influential decisions. That would probably be the one for me.
You know what? I think that country would get invaded, but I think they'd get invaded with very smart Bitcoiners. I think there'd be like a brain race to the first nation that did that.
Yeah. There's a few countries that do apparently hold Bitcoin. You can kind of hazard a guess at which ones and stuff, but I know Bulgaria, they probably sold them off. I think it was Bulgaria or maybe it was Hungary that had like a few thousand Bitcoins that they'd taken off somebody
like they said, stolen them from somebody or confiscated them from somebody that gave them up and stuff. But yeah, it'd be to give that knowledge and thoughts and understanding to somebody in a position that can impart those onto society from the very top. Because as much as I love the ANCAP group, humans fall into packs. Even when you remove leadership, we're tribal animals. So just the leaders that have the most power and influence on a global scale.
Yeah, very cool. All right, Danny. Well, thank you so much for your time, mate. It's been great getting to know you a little bit and hearing your story. Thank you for, you know, sharing everything, being so open, so honest, and so inspiring with what you're doing. It's a Bitcoin core company, and you're building it for those people that need it the most, and like making it very, very available. So I think
we're trying. That's all we can do is try.
Well, do you have any final thoughts for listeners?
Get the Premier League started so we can watch Liverpool win the league. I've been waiting 30 years for it.
All right. There you go, FA. you got to listen to Danny Brewster. And where can people find you, mate? What's the best place to send people to?
Either the Bitcoin's Fast Twitter. I don't run it, but or BTC Danny on Twitter. Try not to engage too much on there with people, but I will have a play every now and then. And fastbitcoins.com. If you want to become a merchant, non-merchant, have a skill set that we could possibly use, let us know. Get in touch. We're just a bunch of Bitcoiners trying to move forward in this world.
Love it. Excellent. Thanks so much, Danny.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Everyone, thank you so much for listening. And I hope you enjoyed everything that Danny had to share with us there. What an incredible journey. I mean, talk about ups and downs in a lifetime, you know, and being on the verge of almost going to prison, you know. It's very humbling. It's very humbling when you think about, like, you could have been one or two days away from your life being changed forever, just out of circumstance. And it gives you time to pause and reflect on, it does for me anyway, on everything that's going on right now in the world, in the economic landscape, in every aspect of politics, of modern monetary theory, on what's going on, you know, with the division of people around the world at the moment, and the uprisings we're seeing, or the infighting we're seeing. You know, this is all driven by something. Nobody's born with hatred or skepticism. It's you got to ask yourself, you got to question, you know, what is the cause root of it? What is the core cause root of this? And if as many of us believe in the Bitcoin space, if as many of us believe that the root cause problem is that the money is broken, and at, you know, our very, you know, basic level, you know, the human element of, you know, being able to express value to each other and pay each other for the time that has gone into, you know, a value, the service or product that's being offered, if that's just being manipulated behind the scenes to the point of thievery and robbery, then you got to question, is that a problem? If that is the problem, we should be looking at something else. And you know, Bitcoin could be the answer. And, you know, what Danny's doing with his company and with his ethos and, you know, a Bitcoin-only company and making that available to as many people on the street as possible, just to get hold of a little bit,
just a little bit a week for the next however many years, how that might change their life and their family's life and their future. I think it's amazing. I think it's brilliant. So go check out the company Fast Bitcoin and reach out to Danny on Twitter. And as always, reach out and say hi. You know, a big thanks again. Danny mentioned Obi in the show. Obi's been on, and we had a great interview, and he was kind enough to support the show, and that's coinfloor.co.uk. And if you use /bitten, then you can start your stack and sats journey there. You know, for as little as 50p to a pound a day or something, if you want to, if you can afford more, do more. You know, 10 to 50 pounds a week, whatever it is, just start putting something away for the future. Thanks as always for listening, guys. Really appreciate it. And if you are if you're US based, you can start your stack and sats journey with swanbitcoin.com/oncebitten. I've got an interview coming up with Brady, who's part of the Swan team, and he does a great job of explaining what they are all about. Or you could go back and listen to my interview with Jan Pritzker or Corey Clipston, the co-founders of Swan. Have a great morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you are, guys. Really appreciate you listening. The likes, the shares, the DMs. It's all very humbling. Thanks so much. Take care.